how did African Americans react to slavery? What factors, particularly religion, might shape those reactions, even making them violent? Dr. Patrick Breen, in his carefully researched and cogently written The Land Shall Be Deluged in Blood, published by Oxford University Press in 2015, sheds light on these questions through a meticulous study of the slave rebellion led by Nat Turner. With its careful attention to the historiography on the rebellion, its considerations of the veracity of the confessions of Nat Turner, the primary source that serves as the center of studies on the Rising, and its treatment of how churches reacted to the Rising, this work is not only of interest to scholars, but could easily be adopted into a college-level survey of American history or a course introducing the historian's craft. I hope you'll enjoy the interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Patrick Breen about his new book, The Land Shall Be Deluged by Blood. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So I wonder if we can start off how we usually start off. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a historian up at Providence College, so I'm up in New England, where I've been for 15 years now. But I did my education actually in the South. I got my PhD from the University of Georgia. I've been studying slavery and slave society since actually college. I was at the College of William & Mary in Virginia, and there was a visiting professor coming to town, and my advisor, who knew I was interested in history, said, you know, I think you might want to take this guy. And I did, and the guy's name was Eugene Genovese, and one of the big names in African-American history. And once I had taken his class, I was interested in this material and kept studying it, and, you know, went to grad school, wrote my dissertation, wrote my book, got a job, and now this is what I do.
Well, excellent, excellent. And how did you come to write then this book in particular? What was it that drew you to Nat Turner and to write a monograph about him?
Well, I had been studying Virginia, in part because I had been working in Virginia sources, because from the beginning I had been in Williamsburg and in Virginia. And so I was trying to think of something that would allow me to do a narrow event, to explore a narrow event, to really see how power existed in a slave society. And, you know, I was just banging my head trying to think of, well, what could I do? I don't want it to be too big. I can't do the Civil War because you can't do that. It's just too big. I want something narrow, but that might allow us to see what actually happens. Slavery. And I kept banging my head, and then all of a sudden it occurred to me, of course, Nat Turner was the exact thing that I wanted to do. It had been sitting before me in plain sight. In fact, one of the funny things was when I was in high school, one of my summer reading books was William Styron's The Confessions of Nat Turner. So I had been well familiar with this material for a long time, and I remember reading it as a 17 or 18 year old, and just reading the first 10 or 15 pages, thinking, is this real? What really happened? And as it turns out, I went through and did a dissertation writing about it, and then wrote a book about it.
Well, and that goes to the center of your book, because there's a lot of controversy about the veracity of the confessions of Nat Turner. So could you tell us, and that's key, because it's like a central document for the Rising. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. This is the actual key to understand the revolt. After the revolt, Nat Turner's captured and taken to jail, where he's going to be held for about a week until he's tried. And while he's in jail, he purportedly gives his confession to a white lawyer named Thomas R. Gray. Thomas R. Gray writes this thing. It's a short confession. It's, you know, 15, 16 pages, and gets it off to the publisher, and it's published within a month. And originally, people thought, well, this is just the confessions of Nat Turner. Here's a guy that's about to die. Someone decided to write it up, and it's his confessions. But this became obviously problematic, especially once we started focusing on the, you know, as a profession, historians started focusing on the voices of the powerless. Was this really Nat Turner's voice? Was it Thomas Gray pretending to be Nat Turner? So in about the 1960s, people started questioning the confessions of Nat Turner. And when William Styron's novel came out in 1967, there was a novel based on this on this document. It immediately, this was a best-selling book, New York Times bestseller. It was won the Pulitzer Prize in history. It's incredibly contentious because he basically said, "I take the Confessions as true, and I will add anything else that's, I won't contradict the Confessions, but I'll add anything else that sort of fits. I'm a novelist." And William Styron was a liberal from Virginia. He had been educated at Duke, but it was up in New York, or Connecticut at this point. And he basically wrote this book that infuriated a lot of people who were into the Black Power movement in the late 1960s. And so it generated a book called 10 Black Writers Respond. And basically, they did not like how Nat Turner was portrayed. This was an enormous fight for about 5 or 8 years in the issues of the New York Review of Books. People are having at each other, is this the Confessions of Nat Turner real or not, and what can you rely on? The problem was, people had their sides. I want to have a more political Nat Turner. I want to go with Styron's Nat Turner. They had their point of view, and they would read the document sort of based on that. They would use it opportunistically. And I thought that that was wrong. I thought that that was completely, you know, that didn't make sense. You can't sit there and say, he's wrong when he's saying this, but he's right when he's saying that. You know, how would you possibly know that? So one of the things I wanted to do when I started this project is I said, you know, I gotta be a little more systematic about this. If this is really Thomas R. Gray, we're not finding out about Nat Turner, we're finding out about what one sort of educated white guy thought of the revolt, which, you know, is an interesting thing, and, you know, it would have been an interesting project. The only problem was, as I kept working with the document, I ultimately convinced myself that Gray did what the people at the time thought he did, which was actually take down Nat Turner's Confessions. And there's a couple reasons that I was, you know, able to convince myself of this. You know, one thing is you can look at the document itself. And this is readily available on the internet. If anyone wants to look at it, they can. When you look at the internal evidence, you notice things like what Thomas Gray says in his account is different from what the stuff that's in quotes where Nat Turner's speaking. They disagree about stuff. And that's, you know, that's, well, if he was making it up, why would he contradict himself? But even more interesting, Thomas Gray put insertions in the text. He sat there and he would put parenthetical notes, like, you know, Nat Turner would say something like, you know, there was a sign from God that we were going to start a revolt. And then in parentheses it would say, the eclipse of the sun, or something like that. And what's going on here is Turner is saying something. Gray doesn't know what the sign is, and so he asks him, you know, and the men I most trusted. Gray asks, who are they? And then he writes it parenthetically. These parenthetical notes are incredibly important because it shows that he's willing to let Turner make a mistake. And ultimately, I think when you look at the story of the battle really, what Gray knows about the battle is different from what Turner knows about the battle. And there's really a strong difference, you know, really sharp differences between the two. And that really allows us to see that what Gray is doing is taking Nat Turner's voice. So one way you can look at it is internally to the document. There's a lot of reasons. And there's much, much more than that. I mean, I wrote a whole chapter on this. But the other basic kind of argument is you can look at the extrinsic stuff, the stuff outside. You know, there's one thing, you know, the Confessions are actually, Gray knows that people are going to wonder if this is authentic. The reason people are reading it is because it's supposed to be Nat Turner's voice. And so he tries to put stuff in where people say, you know, this is actually the Confessions of Nat Turner. The clerk of the court writes an affidavit. Many of the justices sign an affidavit saying that it was read. Now, of course, these could be made up, but I think that there's really good reason to think that they weren't. For example, when he puts together the list of the judges who sentenced Nat Turner to death, he does not include all the judges, including the person who read Nat Turner's confessions to the court. Now, if you're going to be forging these guys' name and just sort of falsely signing their names onto this document, you'd include everyone. But he didn't. And my theory is the reason he didn't include them was because he couldn't get those guys' signatures. Most of them had left court. Most of the judges whose signatures he got stayed around for the next case. And so he was able to get a bunch of signatures for the judges, but not all of them. So when he puts stuff in, I tend to believe it. And then there's other accounts. One account says that I was going to write more about the confessions. Nat Turner was speaking freely to people at the jail, says one newspaper article. And I was going to write more, but someone is writing these down verbatim. So someone at the time is saying he's writing them verbatim. Now, people have come up and none of these are proofs that he did it, but when you look at the entire corpus and you look at it ready to believe that he did it or didn't, I think that the weight of the evidence is strongly on the side that it is actually what Thomas R. Gray says, which is Nat Turner's own voice coming through us, which is really makes it a remarkable document. I mean, some of the greatest sources we have in African-American history, and especially the history of slavery, are slave narratives. Guys like Frederick Douglass write their narratives. Well, this is the narrative of the most important slave rebel in American history. It's such a precious document. And I think as a profession, we've shied away from using it just because of the questions about its authenticity. I think it's a really far richer and stronger document, and it's really well worth looking at. And so when I wrote my book, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to use this document. I'm going to sort of take it as what Nat Turner says. And he might not be right about everything, and he might, you know, there are mistakes in the confessions and confusions and all sorts of problems, and which I don't deny. You know, it's not like God's writing this. This isn't, you know, an omniscient point of view, but it is Nat Turner telling us a story. It's Nat Turner telling his story, and it's such a precious thing that we have it.
Excellent, excellent. And I found this very interesting, and I very much enjoyed. And for our audience, this is in the afterword of the text. So now that Patrick has, you know, I think established very well the veracity of this document and has written a book that uses that document a great deal, could you tell us, Patrick, how does your book then contribute to our understanding of Nat Turner's rebellion in particular and American slavery in general?
Okay. Nat Turner is really one of the most important figures in the historiography of American slavery. And this is a long story. Nat Turner, someone who's been studied, he's famous, people have known about him, even before the Civil Rights era, before the 1950s and 60s, when the historical profession started worrying about African-American history. He was a leader of a slave revolt. People, historians, knew about this. So it's someone that the profession has had to handle and has a long tradition of handling. My book is going to really refine our ideas about resistance. Initially, when slavery was taught, the first generation of professional historians, you're going to be talking about the turn of the 19th century to the 20th century, you're going to be talking about 1900. The profession was not particularly interested in African-American history. The profession was frankly racist, so it wasn't particularly interested in African-American history, and it wasn't particularly interested in African-American agency. You know, obviously slavery becomes something that's really bad if slaves are people who basically have the same rights as whites. Now, in 1900, lots of people thought, well, maybe they're human or whatnot, but they certainly don't deserve the same rights as whites because they're inferior. You know, there was a lot of racism around. And so Nat Turner is this figure who's just created, who's outlandish. He doesn't really fit. It's someone, there's a book written about him in 1900, written by a guy who's from Southampton, whose family had members who were, I think, died in the revolt. This is not a sympathetic portrait of Nat Turner. And the point was, Nat Turner didn't really fit. What those white historians taught about slavery was it wasn't really a bad situation. It wasn't a terrible thing. U.B. Phillips, one of the most important scholar of American slavery before the Civil Rights Movement, who was unsympathetic to the Civil Rights Movement, basically used the metaphor of a school. You know, slavery is like a school. It's not that bad. You don't have complete rights. It's in a school, the teacher's in charge, and you're not. Why? Because you're inferior. And so he used that as the model. When this view was being attacked, and it was attacked by radical historians and African-American historians, one of the easiest places to attack that this was a good system and that people were happy under it and that African-Americans weren't really agents, weren't really trying to change the system, is to look for the people who tried to resist. One of the interesting stories is W.E. Du Bois, the famous civil rights activist, had wanted to do a biography of Frederick Douglass. And he got turned down because his rival, Booker T. Washington, was enlisted to do it. And so the publisher sort of goes back to him and says, well, is there anyone else you want to do? He says, well, yeah, sure, I'll do Nat Turner. And the publisher's like, no, this is not a good idea. It's 1900. We don't want to start celebrating someone like Nat Turner. So they eventually convinced him, if you want to do a rebel, do John Brown. And he did that. Unfortunately, we never got Du Bois' take on Nat Turner. It would have been a great one. But Herbert Amsiker, a communist historian, got his master's in 1937 at Columbia University. Herbert Amsiker was attacking the old historiography of guys like Phillips. He's saying, no, this is not a good system. This is not basically okay. We're not going to put up with it. And so he's trying to find examples of people who resist. The very first person you're going to hit on is Nat Turner, and he wrote his master's thesis on Nat Turner. He expanded it into a dissertation where he tried to show that many people tried to resist slavery, which, of course, they did. There were many people who tried to resist slavery. And so this really launched the movement to really see slavery, slaves, as people, as full human people who are autonomous and had their own, were trying to do their own things. They were their own agents. So Nat Turner's at the turning point of that. Now, I think the problem comes when you look at Nat Turner, you say, look, African-Americans didn't like slavery. African-Americans tried to fight slavery, which is true. But there's a movement to sort of make resistance the ultimate part of the African-American experience. That resistance is the heart and the soul, and it's what it means to be African-American. And it's not that I'm dissatisfied with that, because I think the African-American community in slavery is far more diverse than that. There's far many different responses, people going different places, and to sort of create sort of one blanket idea of what it means to be an African-American slave, to be an African-American slave is to be constantly resisting slavery, I think doesn't see how rich it is. African-American slaves did resist slavery, and others didn't, and there's a whole range of responses, and they have a whole lot of different reasons, and I think that the intricacy of these responses and the intricacy of this world is something that we miss, because historians, in making their arguments, have been trying to put resistance at the center of the African-American experience. And I think resistance belongs as a part of the African-American experience, but it really warps the African-American experience, the experience of slavery, to sort of assume that basically for a couple hundred years, you have the Civil War constantly being fought out in advance. It's not. It's not. There's some people who are going to be doing this, and there's some people who are not. And that's one of the things about what it means to live in an African-American society, to live in a slave society, is that not everyone's on the same page. And that's one of the things I think my story of the Nat Turner Revolt really, really shows.
Yeah, and I think it shows that really well, and I'm sure that will come in over and over again as we continue through our interview. But for people who maybe aren't too familiar with the story, moving to your first chapter, Signs, could you tell us a little about who Nat Turner was as a person before the rebellion?
Sure. Nat Turner was a slave who was born on October 2nd, 1800. He was 31. Was 30 when the revolt started, 31 when he died. He was a slave in Southampton County, Virginia. Southampton County is on the border of Virginia and North Carolina, so southern Virginia. And it's, if you're thinking of the map of Virginia, it's about midway between Richmond and Norfolk or Newport News, sort of on the southern coast there, southern border right in the middle of Virginia. He was married. He had a son who we think is named Reddick. We don't, historians have offered various possibilities as to his wife's name. I'm not confident in the sources that we have. I don't think any historians have really shown us that some of the people aren't the spouse. So there's things we don't know, and there's always going to be things that we don't know about slaves and enslaved people. There's always going to be things we don't know about people from a couple hundred years ago. These their entire lives are not recorded. But he was a slave. He was not an especially valuable slave, so he was not a particularly skilled slave, although he was, according to his confessions, he was a religious man and certainly a religious figure of note. Some people call him a preacher. He's not really a preacher. He's more of an exhorter. He isn't formally aligned with any church, but he does go out and he's religiously active. So before the revolt, the last thing is he's literate. Not all slaves, of course, knew how to read. You know, the estimates of the number of slaves who knew how to read is 10-20%, so this isn't incredibly unprecedented, but it certainly is not common. So he was someone who knew how to read.
And if I remember right, didn't he claim that God taught him how to read?
No. Oh. No. He spoke to God, according to the
right.
confessions, something that, this is one of the things I don't have a problem believing. But he said that it was a miracle that he learned how to read. He wasn't taught. And so he took it as a sign of God that he learned how to read. Now, this is one of the places he disagrees with Gray. When Gray writes it, he says his parents taught him how to read. He didn't believe any of the stuff that Turner was saying. The religious stuff, Gray clearly didn't believe, but he did see it as a sign that he was chosen, because he really did. He thought he was a chosen person. He was a messianic figure, and his exact messianic status is sort of hard to figure out. But he certainly saw himself as someone who was responsible for. Doing what God told him to do, which included starting the revolt. So when he gets told by God, he gets a series of visions from God. And in fact, one of the visions is really interesting, and I make a fair bit of this in my book. He escapes slavery once when he's a younger man in his 20s. No, this isn't that unusual. Other people had escaped. In fact, his father had escaped slavery, at least according to the confessions. And so when he does, he goes away for a month. And eventually he comes back. And, it's like, why did you come back? Well, there's lots of reasons you come back from running away from slavery. I don't like slavery, but I don't like sleeping with the snakes either. So, I go back. Or, I'm hungry. Or, whatever. There's lots of reasons to go back. But when he got back, he told the people the reason he went back was because the Spirit told him to. And the interesting thing in the confessions is he says, and then the Negroes found fault and murmured against me. Now, they didn't believe him. It was funny. As he was growing up, people were willing to believe that this guy was sort of religiously inspired. And then when he started saying, well, now God sent me back to slavery, they're like, no. That's not the God. That's not our God. And so he became, I argue, certainly he was aware of disagreements in the black community. He knew that everyone wouldn't follow him just because he said. And this is one of the things that makes him different from some of the religiously inspired people who are involved in these terrible events like the mass murders or whatnot. They're out there and they're basically trying to force people to do what they say. He's not. He understands that people aren't going to be working just because he says. It's not a religious. He religiously inspired and uses that authentically, but he understands that he does not have religious authority over most people. So he's perfectly willing to accept people who don't agree with him, who disagree with him. He knows that this is going to be how the revolt takes place. Not everyone's going to come because they believe that Nat Turner is sort of this divine prophet that everyone has to follow.
Right, and how does this... You know, this religious aspect, how does that shape the origins of the rebellion?
Well, what happened is he had a series of religious experiences, visions, you know, including the one I talked about where he was he ran away. And then ultimately, you know, he gets this vision where he sees the clouds in the sky and he sees black armies and white armies fighting against each other. So like, oh, the idea of race war starts creeping in. Although it must be said at this point, his very first disciple is a white guy, Brantley. It's not like he's preaching race warrior stuff. It's or race war. He's, you know, he's a visionary, and you know, he's sort of on the fringe, I think. But in February, he sees an eclipse of the sun, and he takes that as God saying it's time for him to get his recruits in. And so, in February of 1831, he told his four closest friends that he was going to do this revolt. And and this is a chance where they could easily say, you know, you're crazy, don't do it. They could easily go to the whites and say, you know that crazy Nat Turner? He's now got a vision saying God's going to kill the white people. You know, I just want to let you know. And, you know, you might get rewarded. You might get it. None of them did. All four of the people he asked to join the rebellion. They kept it a secret. And for the next 6 months or so, they're basically trying to figure out how to start the revolt. Their original plan is to start it on July 4th, right? You know, Independence Day, the day all men are created equal, that Nat Turner was going to start the revolt then. Although when July 4th came, Nat Turner himself said he got sick. He was worried. So they didn't do it. He called it off. In August, another sign came, and this time it's a weird sign. I don't know exactly what it's from. I think it's from a volcano, but the sun appeared a blue-green, according to some accounts, and there are various accounts across the eastern United States where they see this. It wasn't just a localized phenomenon. It was, I think, in New Orleans and certainly in Richmond and other places, and he took that. There it is. God really wants him to start the revolt. And so the next weekend, they started the revolt. But at that point, the revolt was really, really very small.
Right. And why did he want to keep it so small? I mean, I would think you'd want a whole bunch of people to revolt.
You know, it's obvious. You know, there's a couple ways you have a slave revolt. And one way you have a slave revolt is you sit there and say, okay, we're all getting oppressed. And it's a terrible thing. So let's get together, get everyone, and we're going to rise at the same time. And there are stories of great slave revolts like this, especially in Latin America. There aren't any slave revolts quite like that in the United States. You know, he didn't want to do that. And my suspicion, and I think I've got some basis for this, is because he was very careful thinking about what blacks would do when they heard about the revolt. He understood that some would, of course, join the revolt. I mean, if no one would join the revolt, it was just doomed to failure. But he also understood that some wouldn't. One of the early newspaper articles on the revolt had someone objecting that this revolt wasn't going to work. How can we have a slave revolt when, at the beginning, there's only four people involved? Or even by the time of August, there's only six people involved. Anyway, when this potential recruit objected, he was answered by the rebels by saying, and I'm quoting here, the Negroes had frequently attempted similar things and confided their purpose to several, and that it always leaked out. But his, Turner's, resolve was that their march of destruction should be the first news of the insurrection. So one of the great challenges standing in front of slave rebels was keeping it a secret. I mean, you know, and it's not just there's always going to be someone who's going to turn it over to white authorities. You know, there could be just a person who sits there and says, you know, I actually heard about a slave revolt, and, you know, I'm sort of sympathetic to it, but this one person I don't want to die, so I'll tell them. But whatever it was, and it's unclear what they're thinking about in this really tantalizing piece of evidence. What revolt are they thinking about? Are they thinking about Gabriel's revolt or Vesey's revolt or smaller revolts? I mean, Admiral, slave revolts. One thing we need to remember is slave revolts in history don't succeed very often. The Haitian Revolution, which is a successful slave rebellion, is anomalous. Usually slave revolts are crushed. And Turner understood this better than I think many of the historians who've written about him.
Right, and I think it's in your introduction. That's one of my, I don't know if I should say laugh out loud moments, but I love that part where you write something, you know, historians often don't realize. Organizing a slave revolt that's successful is really hard. Oh, here we are. Page 8, you write, it is really hard for a slave revolt to succeed.
Right. You know, and it's one of those things that, unless you say that, you know, certainly this is a book that I was trying to write in a way that it'd be accessible to, you know, a broader audience. You know, one of the things you got to do is you got to remind people this is not, you know, while the aesthetics of the revolt and the politics of the revolt might be very attractive today, the practicality of the revolt, which is something the rebels themselves were very aware of, made it a completely different kind of experience.
So once the revolts, could you tell us, so the revolt starts, what is the first stage of it like, and what role did Nat Turner and another rebel Will play?
Okay. Well, it's interesting. In the first stage of the revolt, Nat Turner is the leader of the revolt, and he's really trying to move himself. I think, you know, I don't want to play psychiatrist. I've only got a couple documents on him. But there is a way in which I think he's trying to establish the authority that he didn't have when the Negroes found fault and murmured against him, when they denied his religious pronouncements. You know, he's trying to make it. You know, there's things like he picks a sword as his weapon, which is great. I mean, you know, they didn't have many weapons, so you could pick all sorts of things. But his sword was a dull one, and in fact, every time he used it, it didn't work. And the one person he killed, he had to sort of throw the sword to the side and bludgeon the girl to death. It was with a fence post. It was not, you know, it was not an effective weapon. But remember, swords is as important for what it means symbolically. He's the leader. And so Nat Turner is going to be the leader. And it's not clear at the very beginning of the revolt if people are really going to trust him. I mean, think about this. You start a slave revolt, you're just like signing your death warrant. And everyone's got to know that. I mean, unless you're just completely out. This is probably not going to work. 4 or 6 of us are trying to overturn our society. And when they catch us, they're going to kill us. So, but one thing you notice is when Nat Turner said, outside the first house, which was Nat Turner's owner's, his master's house, his owner was a young kid in the house. But Nat Turner's, when they get outside, he says, okay, now you guys have been boasting about how you're going to kill people once the chance comes. So here's your chance to go kill them. And they said, no. Nat Turner, you got to spill the first blood. They didn't want to follow him if he could just sort of wash his hands of it and say, well, I didn't kill anyone. I wasn't, I don't know. I mean, I was talking about what God wanted us to do, but I don't know who they were. They made him strike the first blow, and he did. And he didn't kill his master, he just sort of stunned him. Then his master was killed by this guy, another slave named Will. And Will's an interesting figure because he's not a disciple of Nat Turner. In fact, he's one of the few people who's asked, whose explanation for why he joins the rebellion actually makes it into the historical record. And he says nothing about Nat Turner's religion or anything like that. You know, he says, basically, I want to fight for my freedom or I'm willing to die. And Nat Turner's like, okay, that's fine. So, but here he is. He is a political fighter, and he's the man Nat Turner's eventually going to call his executioner. Most of the people who are killed in the first dozen or so people who are killed, most can be traced. In fact, everyone can be traced likely to Will until the first gunshot of the revolt, which is the next morning, and I think the 9th casualty. So Will is incredibly powerful fighter, and he's killing people, and he becomes, you know, the most important of the fighters, but not he's a follower of Nat Turner, the political leader. It's interesting, when the trials come, Nat Turner's referred to in the court records of the other people, and he's called Captain Nat. general man, whatever. He's not called preacher Nat or prophet Nat or some of the other things that people will be emphasizing later in the history. And in that sense, Will's a follower of him. He's a follower of the general man, Captain Nat, and he's going to be his most effective fighter.
And you talk, and I mean, this chapter and the third chapter, it's really just chilling, the violence that you describe. It's horrific. You know, I kind of got chills as I read it. But, you know, so they go through and they have this idea, we're going to kind of engage in this general massacre. This will help to lead to this rising. That's their hope. How then, though, as they're conducting this massacre, they're meeting a bunch of slaves, because most of the people they massacre are slave owners. How do these slaves react to the presence of Nat Turner and his forces?
Yeah, this is where they rolled the dice. They said, you know, they were trying to figure out a way to make this revolt work, and they couldn't. And they're like, well, it doesn't really make sense. We've got four guys. They got, you know, thousands. They got the army. We don't have anything. They said, well, the only way we can get it to work is if we have a grand general uprising. But remember, they said, we can't have an uprising where we tell everyone about it in advance because the whites will find out. So how are we going to get the blacks to all of a sudden rise? And one of the things they do, and I'm the first one to point to this, is they come up with the idea of, if we start killing whites, including women and children, you know, blacks will see that this really is the time to uprise. This is, you know, the fear that we have of whites is going to sort of dissipate. Now, this isn't guaranteed to work. I don't think it's a very likely plan, but then again, you sit down and think about it for a couple of years, it's hard to come up with a very likely plan to succeed. But they said, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to try to make it easier for the blacks to join us. And they thought this would work. Now, some blacks did join. You know, they certainly had, you know, 60, maybe 80 people with them by the end. Not everyone was especially willing. Not everyone was an active fighter. But, you know, they certainly had dozens. And these were mostly, the people traveling with them were men. Very few exceptions, and young men, again, with very few exceptions. So people did rise up. This is the moment where all the frustration and anger we've had at the system of slavery, you know, we can finally do what we've wanted to do. But at the same time, other people did. You know, and the slaveholders are going to write about this later, you know, weeks later, as they're trying to figure out what happened, and they're going to say, you know, a month later in the Richmond Whig, there's a person wrote a letter saying, quote, I must here pay a passing tribute to our slaves, but one which they richly deserve. It is that there's not a single instance of disaffection in any section of our county, save on the plantations which Captain Nat visited. And to their credit, the recruits were few, and from the chief settlements among them, not a man was obtained. So he's saying, at the big plantations, no one was recruited. And I think you go through and you look at some of the big plantations that Nat Turner's men visited, and like there were, New Harris has you know, something like 80 slaves, and he didn't. And there's no evidence that any slaves from New Harris's plantation joined. So this is not, I mean, it's not completely right, because there were a couple of people who joined the revolt who weren't from plantations that Nat Turner visited. Certainly there were people who tried to join the revolt, but not many. The basic idea here, I think, is more right than wrong. It was very hard, and the revolt was basically rolling the dice and saying that the blacks would rise once they heard that there was an army of blacks killing whites, and it didn't happen. And so this, you know, it's going to take a day or two for the revolt to be put down, but it never gets that sort of power that some of the revolts had. Never had thousands of people involved, which could have happened. I mean, Southampton County is a county where you've got a fairly even split in the population between African American people and whites, but the vast majority of the blacks, I think, you know, and from what we can see, most of them are going to be trying to lay low and stay, not get involved. So there's going to be people who join, there's going to be people who don't join, and there's going to be people who are divided. One of the great stories I love is the story of Thomas Hathcock. Jack and Andrew had been at Catherine Whitehead's plantation, and they fled. You know, the rebels come and start killing people. These are young boys, probably early teenagers, maybe, you know, 10, 11, 12, whatever. They fled, and one of the places they go is to Thomas Hathcock's house. Thomas Hathcock's a free black.
And he sits there, and they say, what should we do? And he basically says, Thomas Hitchcock basically says, well, if Nat Turner says you got to go, you got to join him. And he says, not only that, if you wait a second, I'm going to get some food, get my coat on, I'm going to join you guys. So he turns to his wife and basically says, get me some food. And she basically starts saying, no, don't do it. Are you crazy? This is not going to work out well. And so you see these divisions happening even within a single family in the black community. Someone who's on the outskirts, a free black, who's like, doesn't necessarily have to join, joins. But then his wife is sitting there saying, you know, don't do this. Don't leave me and our child, without a father. That's not what I want. So there are really deep divisions. But the plan of having a mass uprising never happens. And the revolt is going to be suppressed pretty quickly.
Right. And how is it? I mean, how is it finally put down?
Well, the whites start chasing blacks. I mean, basically whites flee from their houses once they hear that this happens, and they gather in the woods and wherever. But eventually some houses become strongholds and the families gather there, and then basically start riding after, white men start riding after the rebels. And the rebels are making their way to Jerusalem. They are chased by these guys, and eventually, one group of them catch up to them while they're on James Parker's farm. They're recruiting at James Parker's farm. There's actually a group by the gate, which is away from the farm, a group of rebels. Those rebels are dispersed, which isn't surprising because they're sort of the more hesitant rebels. Then this maybe a dozen people, 20 people, come down and are engaged with the slave forces. And the first group, actually, the slaves drive them from the field. The way firepower works at the time, you couldn't take two shots with a gun. You got one shot and you're out. And so once the whites had shot at the blacks, the slave army, which is several dozen, was able to come up and chase them away. But there had been another group of whites who heard the sounds of had heard the gunfire and had followed them up and set up an ambush and were able to ambush the slaves who had been chasing the first army back. This led to complete chaos. The rebels were dispersed. Nat Turner was separated from people. They're trying to get the army together. Eventually they get about 40 people together when they spend the night that night at one plantation. Interestingly, they're at the slave quarters at Ridley's plantation. The whites had a strong house at the plantation house, so they're on the same plantation, sort of warily eyeing each other. But the slaves were very worried at that point. The rebels were very worried at that point. And they hear stuff in the night, horses galloping, shotguns being fired, and eventually it leads to sort of a panic among the rebels. Nat Turner realizes that their sleep is over, gets his group up together, and tries to go to another one of these plantations, Simon Blunt's farm. And it's at this farm, they're bushwhacked. The whites hadn't left the plantation. They thought the whites had left the plantation, so they were just going to try to recruit the slaves. But the whites hadn't left. And, the rebels were, the guys holding the place were able to take free shots at the rebels who were approaching the farmhouse. This sent the rebels into complete disarray again. And by the end of that day, sort of Tuesday, the second day of the revolt, the rebels were no longer a cohesive fighting force. And there would be scattered rebels seen throughout the area for a week, maybe. Although Nat Turner himself would be able to escape for about a month. He wasn't discovered. The revolt happened in August 21st and 22nd of 1831. He's not discovered until the end of October.
Right. And after the revolt, then, there was this great fear among the white population, and groups of whites started to massacre blacks, but then they stopped. Could you tell us a little bit more? What stopped that process?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. surprisingly, the whites were, I mean, not surprisingly, I think, the whites were enraged. I mean, this the idea that people were going to come and kill, as they saw it, innocent women and children, was infuriating to the whites. And so there's going to be a lot of people who were incensed at what was going on. The problem was, this created an enormous problem for the slaveholders. Because, you know, it wasn't legal in the South to go kill someone's slave property. You know, it was not legal to kill a cow. It's not legal to kill their slave property. But the problem was, it was essentially unenforceable after a slave revolt. If you went out and killed someone's cow, they'd say, you killed the cow. Why'd you do that? You know, you have to pay me compensation. You take them to court and you can get it. You killed someone's slave, they could take you to court. You say, I thought he was a slave rebel. Is any court going to find him responsible? No. It's a time when whites really could act brutally to blacks. And I think, you know, there's an incredible fear. One of the things I talked about in the introduction is, you know, something that they didn't have a word for at the time, the genocide. The idea that the whites could start just killing blacks, the entire black population, was something that was on people's radar at the time. It was something that people were afraid of. I mean, when I got the title for my book, The Land Shall Be Deluged in Blood, this is the vision people have. The book is not about, the title actually is not about the blacks killing whites. It's actually about the whites killing blacks. That's where that quote comes from. It's a great quote. But, so what happened is the slaveholders started realizing that their property was really vulnerable. You know, think about this. It's in today's society, if you were all of a sudden going to get rid of real estate, you're going to get rid of the stock market or something. That's how vulnerable people were. And so the slave owners started trying to figure out ways to protect their slave property. And, you know, initially, one of the things they did is try to move it from this system where people were getting killed. Just, you know, we might think of it as lynching and extra legal procedures. You know, you just find someone in battle, you capture someone in battle, and you kill them. Ultimately, they wanted to move it into a judicial process, and leaders were able to do that. And then once it got into the judicial process, one of the things that's notable is how few people are going to be killed. You know, they had a lot of protections. The slave owners gave the slaves a lot of protections. There were people who had their court cases thrown out because the indictment was drawn up incorrectly. You know, they were accused of treason. You can't accuse a slave of treason. They're not a citizen. How can they be treasonous? You know, like, but so what happens? Those guys are let go. I mean, it's amazing how much the leaders were trying to make the revolt seem small. And the reason I argue in my book is not because they were especially sympathetic to slaves or slaves' plight, but because they were worried about the dangers that could come from a white population that would feel free to kill African Americans. And so that is. I argue that they were very successful, and in fact, one of the things I argue is that the number of blacks killed after the revolt is much lower than any of the estimates that people have had for the last 100 years or so. When people have looked at the numbers, it's much, much higher, and I think that the number of people killed after the revolt without trials is probably in the 30s, and so the total number of African Americans killed in the revolts, when you count trials and non-trials, is going to be actually about the number of whites killed. It'll probably be somewhere in the 50s. It's sort of a remarkable thing, which, you know, is not how we imagine our world, certainly not how people portray it or think about it. And, you know, given so much of what we know about African-American history and the sort of the violence that came from much less provocation, it's sort of surprising to see that the numbers were as low as they are.
And you mentioned the importance and the power of slaveholders in shaping the trials. Could you tell us how they shaped the narrative of the revolt that came out of the trials?
Right. So the slaveholders were completely in control of the courts. To be a member of, to be a judge, you were a slaveholder, and you weren't just a slaveholder. You were one of the more important slaveholders. And that's true of pretty much everyone involved in the process, the sheriffs, the DAs. Well, there's one DA, there's one prosecuting attorney who's actually the son of a major slaveholder who's in charge of the military response. charge of this. And what they're trying to do, what they do is they use their power as military leaders, as lawyers, as judges, to say, you know what, this is not a sign that all the slaves are dangerous. In Southampton, they do a really good job of saying, you know, I want to find evidence of you that you were involved. And more than that, that you weren't just sort of dragooned and forced to go, but that you were a willing participant. And so there was a high bar. It's sort of interesting. There's another set of trials that takes place in the next county over. Whites aren't sure if this is a broad revolt or not. And so in the next county over, they start trying people, and they are much less concerned about the African Americans and whether their rights are being prosecuted. In fact, one of the things that happens is some people are going to be discharged in Southampton and then charged in Sussex County. Well, as it turns out, they see the revolt. Any sign of caring about the revolt was a sign that you were involved in the revolt, and you were a participant, you were willing, and you should be executed. Sussex County ends up convicting a lot of people. And there's an interesting story that comes out of this. A guy named Boston is convicted, but breaks out of jail. There's a jailbreak. There's a half dozen, actually 8 or 9 people in the jail waiting their execution. They're going to die, so, you know, why not die today instead of tomorrow? They stage a jailbreak. And interestingly, this one guy makes it away, and he makes it away for 3 or 4 years. And finally, he's recaptured in 1835. And when he's recaptured, you see these letters, and the court says, we were wrong. We thought everyone was involved in the revolt, and that it was a big revolt that was dangerous, and we had to kill all these people, and we were wrong. And they look at the case of Boston, and they're writing a petition to the governor to commute his sentence, and saying, you know, he didn't deserve to die. And it's sort of interesting, because when they do this, they say, we were wrong, and the Southampton court shows that this was small, that not a lot of people were involved in it, and this revolt was really not that dangerous. And so that idea was a very powerful one, and it was able to ultimately stop whites who didn't have slaves from revolting and other slave owners who were terrified from outside the county from responding in a way that would be really dangerous to the slaveholders of Southampton County.
Well, excellent, excellent. Now, what I and you've done a great job with the narrative of the book itself and this kind of historiographical examination and description of how all this went down. And one thing also I liked about this book, and one reason I thought it would be, you know, interesting for the Christian Studies Channel to look at, was you have this chapter 8 entitled Communion that looks at how the rebellion affects local churches. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your findings there.
Sure. It's one of the neat chapters. I was sitting there trying to figure out, there's two voices that are really hard to find. One is the voice of African Americans. You know, finding and ultimately deciding that Nat Turner was reliable was a great way to do this. But the other voices are, what about the people who wanted to kill blacks? The whites in Southampton County who aren't slaveholders, or maybe only own one slave, but most of them don't own any slaves. What did they think? And we've got a couple letters. We've got a petition to Andrew Jackson, of all things, saying, you know, these slaveholders are completely out of their mind. They sent the army away, you know, and they wanted Andrew Jackson to send the army back down to secure Southampton County, something that the Andrew Jackson and his administration did not do. But these guys, what did they think? How do I know if they ultimately accepted the story that the whites told, that the white leadership told, that this wasn't really a big affair? And the place I found the records that I used as a proxy was ultimately in the churches. In the churches after the revolt, the question came about whether you were going to have interracial communion. These were interracial churches. You know, the separate black churches were not common in the South before the Civil War. So were you going to have Christians getting together and sharing communion, whites and blacks? And this was a debate that was held throughout the region. You know, could you have communion, brothership, you know, fellowship? You know, could you see someone as your brother who you think is trying to kill you? And what I found is ultimately that in every church I found the records for, they did support interracial communion. Now, there's a really interesting story at one church, because a group of people say, no, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't have interracial communion. And they eventually, they said they rejected the settlement of the church, which took a year to get to and was very contentious. And when they left the church, they didn't accept it. And then when the church decided to bring the blacks into communion after a year, they decided to leave the church. And ultimately, I think they were bluffing. They said, you know, you got to choose. You're either going to have this group of white people who don't want to be part of the church, or you get to have the slaves. And ultimately, the church, which was governed not by the slaveholders, this is a Baptist church, so it's going to be governed by the white members. Blacks obviously aren't going to be voting. They're not going to be controlling what the church policy on black membership is going to be. But the white church says, no, we're going to have blacks as members. And they gave the whites their letter of dismission. They said, you're out of here. And a couple months later, the whites come back and say, actually, well, still want to be part of the church, and that was all well and good. But ultimately, that vision of not having the entire black community set against slavery and not figuring out a way to have community with black community, with the black community, the whites ultimately came to accept, I think, what the slave leaders, the slaveholders were arguing, which was Nat Turner's revolt was a small sort of fringe thing, and it wasn't sort of the voice of the black community and what they really felt. And so it's a really interesting little short chapter that I really enjoy.
No, I found it fascinating, and it's as your whole book. And one thing that I think is particularly interesting, one reason I wanted to interview you about your book in particular is, I mean, it can't help but have some connection to the complex racial, what can I say, context we face now in the United States. And you recognize that in the book and your conclusion. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what message do you think this rebellion has for us today?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a way in which the revolt is used in a political sense. We're trying to understand everything sort of African-American history is used entirely through these political lenses. And I think that we have to remember that the African-American community and the issues we face are far richer than just sort of the simple question of politics, which isn't to say the question of politics isn't there. It clearly is. But to try to simplify and see, you know, the story of African American history as a story of oppression and resistance, I think ultimately misrepresents somewhat, well, not very much, sort of the oppression against them, but it certainly misrepresents the diversity of responses in the African American community to the struggles and the challenges that they've faced. And I think that today, you know, there's a sense that, you know, when we're dealing with these questions of race, and, you know, I think that we have to remember that there's far richer stories here that we have to be attuned to. You know, that the religion, you know, the question of religion, the question of family, the question, these various questions are important questions and important parts of the African American experience. And it's sort of myopic to just sort of look at it and say, well, ultimately, what we need to know about slavery was bad, and African Americans resisted it. And I'm like, well, no, it's far richer than that. And so the lesson of slavery, I think, also going to be a little more nuanced than we just need to undertake sort of some single politics is ultimately going to some single politics, single political solution is what we need.
Well, excellent. Well, and I, like I said, this is a very rich book, and it's hard for us to do justice in just 1 hour. But I think we managed to hit a lot of your main arguments, and I really did find this fascinating. And I want to end then with our traditional question. What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on Alexis de Tocqueville, a French figure pretty well known who came to America in the 1830s at the same time as the Nat Turner Revolt and wrote about American history. His book, one of the most famous books in the 19th century, it's Democracy in America, 2 volumes. And race is at the end of the first at the end of the first volume, he writes this incredible volume, which is basically talking about democracy in America. And then he sort of ends it and says, okay, now at the end, now there's a problem I didn't address, which is race. And so I'm trying to work through and work on Alexis de Tocqueville and his ideas on race and how it fits into how we understand the racial situation of America then and now. So that's my current project.
Excellent. Well, it sounds fascinating. Well, thank you again, Patrick, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. I want to thank you for listening to this interview, and I hope you'll come back and listen to another one soon.